And with that, I just want to go ahead and welcome now to the podium, Jim L. from Orchid.
Go, Jim.
Alrighty. Jim, alcoholic.
Well,
I'm extremely nervous to do this, so bear with me. I have a sobriety date. It's 7/11 of 2016. I have a home group. It's the men's stag meeting at the Presbyterian Church on Thursday nights. I have a sponsor who's sitting in front of me, who has a sponsor who's, I believe, is here also. And Glenn, thank you for asking me to do this, although I don't know how pleased I am with you. So the first thought when I was asked to do this that went through my mind is I could get drunk and do this, because that's what I used to do. I coached soccer for years, and one of the problems I had was dealing with the parents. And, you know, at the end of the year, you have to go up and give little trophies to the kids. And every year, I would just get plastered to do that, just to deal with, you know, talking to people, because it's definitely a fear and I'm uncomfortable doing it. And then my second thought was, well, I could get drunk beforehand and then I won't be able to do this. And that's just the way my mind works. You know, it's, I don't know, I don't have very good thinking a lot of times. So when I first came into these rooms, I had a hard time relating with a lot of you. And I remember I was at the Champion Center, and somebody, a panel had come in, and somebody was sitting telling their story, and they basically ended up homeless, begging for money, on the streets. And I remember sitting there going, oh, I'm fine. I'm not an alcoholic. I never ended up on the streets. I never ended up homeless. And one of the counselors there, it was a great analogy, and the way he explained it to me was your bottoms are kind of like an elevator. You can get off on any floor. The bottom floor is death. Maybe a floor up above that is, maybe you're incarcerated. Floor up above that, you lose your job, your wife, your kids. And then the top floor is peace, serenity, and one with God. I was fortunate enough to jump off that elevator before I lost the whole bunch. So it was difficult for me to relate to some of you, but I discovered that I could be that in, you know, anytime I jump back on that elevator, anytime I pick up a drink, I'm going to end up, you know, going down. It's never going to go up for me. So, stay. I was speaking at our men's stag meeting the other night, and somebody pointed out to me that I don't address the people when I'm talking, and I look up all the time. So if you see me looking up, it's me asking God to help me get through this. Okay, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Okay. I was the middle child. I had an older brother, a younger sister, both who have had some sort of problem. I grew up in the Orange County area with a dad that was an alcoholic, although he's not in the program and doesn't. I don't even know if he really acknowledges he was an alcoholic. But when I was about 4 years old, I can remember him sitting in his Lazy Boy and then me going and fetching his beer for him. He would, we had a bar with a keg and a tap, and at 4 years old, he would teach me how to pour the beer just right, you know, turn it, you know, pour it slow coming out so you don't get the head on it. And I didn't really think anything of it. That Coors truck would come to our house once a week and, you know, refill that keg. My parents were super social people. They had tons of parties. And I remember just as a kid, just looking at that, thinking, wow, that's really cool. I want to, you know, do that someday. When I was in the sixth grade, my parents moved me from the Orange County area to Santa Maria. I remember moving here and thinking, oh my gosh, there's a bunch of hicks that live in this town. Because, I mean, this is back in the, probably the mid-80s. And there was just, you know, it was totally different from what I was used to. And I can remember going to school and just not relating with anybody. I just didn't understand how the kids acted, I just felt super uncomfortable. I grew up with a severe learning disability. I had dyslexia. I had a very hard time reading, and I was made fun of a lot in school. I can remember kids, you know, when we would be in the classroom and it would come around the table, you know, the teacher would have you read, and I can remember, you know, just being scared that, you know, it's going to be my turn, I'm not going to know the words, kids are going to laugh at me, and that's exactly what happened. So it took me a long time to be comfortable reading in front of people and talking in front of people because of that. So back to alcohol. I started drinking when I was probably about 14. My brother took me to a party, and I remember they were high school kids. I was in junior high, and I looked up to him. I thought, oh, wow, that's cool. I want to do that. And so I started drinking. And from the first time I picked up a drink till I stopped on July 11th, I drank alcoholically. I always drank with a purpose. There was never, you know, let's go have a beer. It just, that's stupid. You know, let's go have 12 beers. That's fun. You know, that's just the way I did. So I went 25 years of drinking like that. In high school, I started drinking, then got into smoking pot, and I was one of those kids that just, I don't want to say I didn't apply myself, but I struggled in school. I never graduated junior high. I never graduated. They just kind of pushed me along. I got into high school. I flunked out of every class I was ever in. I ended up at Delta and just getting my GED. And the only way I did that is I discovered this white substance that back then we called crank. I don't know what they call it now, but we snorted it, and it just, like, got me so motivated to do anything. I could sit down and, you know, and finish anything. So with the help of crank, I ended up graduating high school. Give me a second here. After high school, because I had that learning disability, the state paid for me to go to a trade school. So I went to a trade school to become a heating and air conditioning technician, which was something that I kind of was good at. I could work with my hands, I could fix things. So I went to the Bay Area, went to a heating and air conditioning school, and did okay at that because that was, you know, I was interested, there wasn't a lot of reading, I was able to do that. But shortly after that, came home, I was probably 18 years old, and ended up getting a DUI. I can remember it was on the 101. I had a truck that didn't have a, you know, it was just the bench seat in the front, and I think there was 5 kids in the truck with me, and we all had beers in our lap. It was doing like 85 on the freeway, and, you know, I don't know why I thought I could do that without getting caught, but ended up getting a DUI. That DUI... kind of mess up my life because I went to that heating and air conditioning school. So the type of job you get with that, you're driving around in a car and, you know, you need the driver's license to be able to do that. Without a driver's license, I was like, what now? I don't know if it was my idea or my parents had this brilliant idea to send me to Wisconsin to live with my grandfather, where I can get out of California, get away from my legal problems, kind of get a fresh start because, you know, at this point I'm drinking a ton. So I did a geographical move to try to get away from my problems and get to Wisconsin. I had a grandfather that died with probably 40, 50 years of sobriety in this program. And I moved in with him at first, and he was, you know, going to meetings every day. He had the Serenity Prayer up above his toilet in the bathroom, and I remember reading it going, what the heck does that mean? He could obviously see that I was trouble and I needed help, and he tried to convince me to go to meetings with him. And, you know, at the time I was like, you know, this is my grandpa, this is not me, I do not have the same problem that you had. And it was the same thing. I remember him telling me about his story, and I mean, it was so far off a base from what I pictured, and, you know, me to be, that I just couldn't relate to it. So while in Wisconsin, I immediately got into trouble again. I ended up moving out of the house with my grandpa because he wasn't having me in there, you know, drunk, drinking. He basically kicked me out, so I got my own place in Wisconsin. And I was 18 years old. I was working. I had a job. I was a heating and air conditioning technician, which out there is kind of cool because, you know, it's cold and hot and people, I don't know. I guess my ego started getting me. I kind of felt, I felt good. I felt like people looked up to me. Now, granted, the people I was hanging out with were high school kids. Because don't forget, I'm only 18 years old. So I had my own apartment. I would have high school kids over to party all the time. I had a California fake ID that I would buy them beer and have them over. And I remember being so ticked off that the next day we had a party. A bunch of the kids went home drunk, and I was like, okay, whatever. And the next day, the cop came and gave me a ticket. He didn't catch me doing it, but he heard there was a party there, and the kids said that they drank at my apartment, so I ended up getting serving minors, or, you know, some sort of, I think I was serving to minors. And shortly after that, ended up getting a minor in possession also. So the move didn't really help my problem. It just, you know, kind of kept following me and following me. I'm going through notes. Okay. So shortly after my Wisconsin run, I moved back to town and married my wife, at 21 years old. Our wedding was like a high school party, basically. I mean, we were so young and still hanging out with, you know, friends from high school, and there was an open bar there, and I just got completely plastered, and had to, I guess she had to deal with me, which was kind of the start of it. You know, it kept going on from there. We had our first child. We were very young. And at that point, I started using alcohol to cope with my life, to deal with raising a kid at 21 years old, to just to deal with being, I don't know, I guess I've just always had it there. We kept having kids, so we have five kids. It's funny how the parts that you don't think are going to be funny are funny. So we had five kids in there's 16 years span between the oldest and the youngest. So our oldest is 21 and our youngest is 5. They, especially the oldest ones, saw, they grew up with an alcoholic dad, basically. I can remember, I shared this recently, but I can remember being on a trip at a hotel room, and we were all in the hotel room, and I had an ice chest with me, because I always traveled with an ice chest full of beer. I was drinking a whole bunch that night, and my family got up the next morning to go probably to church, and I wasn't getting out of bed, and one of the little kids, I don't remember who it was, but probably 3 or 4 years old, asked my wife, what's wrong with Daddy? Why isn't he getting up? And she just said, oh, he's sick. He doesn't feel good. Made the typical excuse. And I remember it had to be she went and opened up the ice chest, grabbed a beer out of the ice chest and put it on next to the nightstand and said, will this help Daddy? And it was just, I remember just like wanting to like crawl into my skin and go, oh my gosh, did that really just happen? That was just one of numerous times that I know my kids had to deal with my alcoholism. My second oldest daughter, I used to take to soccer tournaments all the time. And that was a great excuse to, drink. I'm in a hotel room. I'm with a whole bunch of people. Granted, I was supposed to be coaching the team the next morning, which didn't really stop me, but she would beg me, please, Daddy, don't drink on this trip. Please, Daddy. And really what it did is it forced me to hide it, because there was no way that I wasn't going to drink. There was no power great enough to make me to stop, which I kind of discovered later on in life. I can remember waking up in the morning and just kind of probing the kids of what happened the night before, because I really didn't remember. So I had asked, kind of sly questions like, so, how was dinner last night? Not really knowing what we ate. And, kids are great for that, because they don't really, understand what's going on. I was a social drinker. We constantly had people over. We had parties all the time, barbecues. Kids would have friends over. And that slowly started changing, because every time somebody came over, I would at some point get out of hand. I would at some point get out of control. Usually the third bottle of wine and, I'm just a complete ass. So I think the turning point for me was when I started hiding. I started being one of those hiders. I remember my wife looking at me like, why are you having another glass of wine? And that just in my head said, she thinks I'm drinking too much. I have to not drink so much in front of her. So I would go stash a bottle in the garage and then, drink my normal drink in front of her. Meanwhile, I'm running out to the garage to pound as much alcohol as I can get into me to come back to pretend like I was normal. And when I started doing that, every time I went into the garage, I would just drink more and more and more. And it finally got to the point where I was going downhill extremely fast. Right up until the last drink that I had, it was the summer. We had three family weddings within like a 3-week period. And these weren't just like weddings that we had to attend. There was either our kids were in them, we were in them. You know, there was a rehearsal dinner the night before, the whole nine yards. And I had a 3-week vacation. We went on a camping trip, and I went on a 3-week bender that I just drank nonstop. Anytime I can get my hands on alcohol, I was, you know, waking up in the morning, and I remember my biggest accomplishment of the day was to try to get Kahlua or Bailey's in my coffee without anybody knowing. Which, you know, when you're in a campsite or in an RV and there's 5 kids and, you know, a wife in there, that's pretty tricky to pull off. And I did it every single morning. So anyways, that last drunk, my wife was taking the kids to church on a Sunday evening. We had been drinking all day, I had been drinking all day. And I knew I had to go to work the next day, and I don't know what happened, but I decided I had an hour window before they got home. So I found every little bit of alcohol I could in the house and drank it. They came home from church, and I was naked in the backyard drinking out of the bushes. Now, I don't know why every time I got drunk, I ended up naked. I don't know. Is there any naked drunk people here? But yeah, well, it was evening. It was like nighttime. So I'm basically in the bushes in my own house. You know, there's no reason for it. But it was at that point that I ended up breaking down and, you know, saying, I can't do this. I need help. My wife and kids like sprung into action, like they'd been waiting for that day for a really long time. They were on the phone. My older kids were packing my bag while my wife was on the phone with another member here trying to figure out what to do with me. I ended up in Lompoc at the Champion Center, which was the best thing, you know, looking back, that ever could have happened to me. I remember waiting to get out of, or her driving me there, and I mean, to get out of that car was the hardest thing that I ever had to do. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, what to expect. I mean, for all I knew, I was going to a lockdown facility, and it turned out that it saved the rest of my life so far. So when I came into this program, I had zero belief in any kind of God. She had been raising our kids Catholic. I went along with it because I knew nothing else. So I went and I took my kids to church every Sunday, sat there, and just basically, I went to support them. I mean, I never prayed. I'd never been to church growing up. I thought God was, you know, a dumb idea. I remember at the Champion Center, I went to Turtle, and I said, I can't do this program. This is like day 2. I don't believe in God. This is a mistake. I don't know what to do. And I remember her explanation. She said, well, you just have to be willing to believe in God. Are you willing to believe in God? And, you know, I guess I'm willing to believe in God. So just a little bit of willingness is what took me to where I am today. It was just enough to crack open that door to take me to where I am today. So today my life has, I mean, it's just completely changed. Okay, so I secretary a meeting on Tuesday night, or I'm sorry, on Wednesday night. I immediately, when I got out of the Champion Center, got a sponsor who sent me here for my first meeting Friday night, and I met Bob. And I just immediately jumped into the steps. I immediately jumped into this program. Because I did that, I was able to, I was able to get rid of enough of myself to let God into my life. And it keeps unraveling more and more. I've shared this before, but I'm going to share it again. I was taking my daughter to a speaker meeting in San Luis. And this is my 21-year-old now. She might have been 20 at the time. And it was kind of like my chance to make amends to her and spend some time. And she told me a story, and she said, "Dad, I just wanted to tell you this story." She had the year before went on a missionary retreat, like a spiritual retreat to Brazil, and brought back for the whole family a rosary, and, you know, for gifts for the kids. And she didn't give me my rosary that she brought back for me because she just knew that I had no interest in it and I wouldn't really do anything with it. And this is her telling me this. So she said, "Dad, what I did is I took that rosary and I put it underneath your mattress. And we've been taking it as a family to church every Sunday and praying for your recovery on that rosary." And I just got the chills again. And I remember just kind of like getting the chills when she told me that. And it was, you know, it was the start of one of those spiritual experiences that has happened to me. At the same time, I had told her that I never really prayed, but I remember sitting at church and going out. I was so hungover and going out, and I like Googled AA, you know, sitting in the vestibule there. And she just kind of looked at me and she said, "You know, that was you asking for help. And my praying," and it was just one of those experiences that completely changed me. And what it did is it opened up the door a little more for me. At that point, I started kind of believing in the power of prayer. So I decided to start praying myself. So I would get down on my knees at night and start praying, "God, please show yourself to me. Please, you know, give me some sort of sign." It happened slowly, but at that point, I just started being more open to the idea of God. And I ended up joining our church that I had been, you know, I've been sitting in the pews for like 20 years, and I joined probably 4 months ago the RCIA program there. So I'm in the process of going through the Catholic RCIA program. So this Easter, I'll actually be receiving, you know, becoming a full member of the church. If you would have asked me a year ago if this is something that I would be doing, if I'd be standing here, I mean, there's no way that I would ever plan to see myself doing this. So, I don't believe that things happen for no reason. My wife, the very first place we went on a date 23 years ago, she took me to church. We sat in a Catholic church, and I had no clue. I believe now that God put her in my life to get me to where I am now. And, sorry. Okay, so in preparing for this, my older daughter heard that I was doing this, and she told me that, you know, Dad, I had to do a retreat for a bunch of kids, or not for a bunch of kids, but do a retreat, and I was the subject, growing up with an alcoholic dad. So she shared with me some of the, like, it's her viewpoint of everything that happened, and she gave it to me to, like, you know, read, and it was extremely powerful. I pulled some of the stuff out of it, and I'm going to read it. I'm going to try to read it. My dad is an alcoholic. He has been since even before the day he had me at 20 years old. Growing up, I was surrounded by this part of my dad's life daily. I grew up thinking that 3 glasses of wine on a weekday dinner, getting drunk every weekend, and revolving family vacations around the best bars were all normal for families. Most of the time, I didn't think anything of it, other than when there was a wedding, a holiday, sporting event, or camping trip. These were the times that were really hard on my family. His alcoholism was seeming to take control more and more of my father. He had that void inside of him and was killing himself faster and faster. During this time, I turned to my faith. There were 2 ways I could look at the situation. I could either be angry at God, go through this on my own, or I could rely on God's help to get me through it and trust that this tremendous cross my entire family bears is all part of God's plan. The night of his last drunk, I went into his room and got the rosary from underneath his mattress. I clung to that rosary and prayed all night for my father. And then another night of my father being out of control passed, and it was a new day. The whole time my dad was in rehab, my family would come together, get the rosary from under the mattress out, and pray it together for my dad. I believe in a God who enters into our sufferings and undoubtedly did for my family. I slowly put more and more trust in God through this month, believing that this is not a sad story anymore. This is one of hope. And then I'm going to end with this. I had so much more in my mind to say, but it's just not happening. So, when I was in at the Champion Center, my daughter wrote this poem for me, and I hadn't seen it until I pulled out all my old stuff. So when I was kind of preparing for this, this came across, and I'm going to read it. It says, "Daddy, I love you. Daddy, I love you to the moon and back. There is nothing that you lack. And I know that you love me as well. And I know that you love me as well. You tell me often, but even if you didn't, I could just tell. I hope that I can see you soon. I look forward to the day. But until then, for you, I will pray. I hope they treat you well there with love and lots of care. But I know that they do because everybody just loves you. I wish I could read this to you, and I bet that you wish that too. I'm trying to fight back my tears, but I really should have no fear, because I know that you will get better. But anyways, I hope you loved this letter. I miss you lots. Love, Olivia." And if it wasn't for this program, the support I get out of you guys, this letter doesn't happen. These kids don't have a dad. They don't, you know, their lives are just back to a wreck for them, you know. This program has saved my life. I know it can save your guys' life too, or the newcomers that are here, if you just give it a chance. Yeah, that's all I got.
Let's give Jim another round of applause.
Good job.